It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Get ready for the thrill of your life. Now, Universal plunges you into a mystery at the speed of sound. Roller coaster. Accident in California.
Less two accidents in 1 week. Who's putting the lid on this? The police?
A recording from a stranger.
Get on the ride, Harry.
A drop in Virginia.
Harry.
Yeah.
Remember what happens when you don't follow directions.
And a man in the middle on the ride of his life.
They're over the lift. It's too late to stop them now.
Let's go.
Coaster.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am joined, as always, by Mr. Sean Whalen.
I'm in sense-around today, Paul.
I can tell. It's early, please.
I got coffee. Doesn't matter what time it is.
There you go. We are joined today by Scott H, and by H, I'm going to say the H is silent, and it's for amusement park. Gardner. Hey, Scott.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, we are here at your suggestion today. This episode is coming out on July 5th. I hope all our listeners still have all 10 fingers, assuming they started with 10, and that nobody had any problems with their 250th celebration. And we're here, and you suggested a movie that has, I'm going to say, a touch of a 4th of July theme. It's not really focused on the 4th so much, but it's 4th of July adjacent. And it's the 1977 movie Roller Coaster. And I'm going to, you know, we had been doing a series of episodes on disaster movies. We did Airport. We did The Spy Adventure. We did Earthquake. We did The Towering Inferno. And this was on the list of ones to do. And I'm not saying we've given up on that particular project. We probably will revisit it at some time. But this was on the list of ones to do. And that project has kind of gotten put on the back burner for a while. We haven't done one in a while. And you suggested we did this. And I could have sworn that I've seen this before. And maybe I did. But I had no memory of it as I was watching it. I watched it, you know, on my big screen, tried to pump up the surround sound and create a little Sean sense around experience. I was up for it. Let's put it that way. But I had no memory of it as I was watching it.
Well, there's a couple of reasons I suggested this one. Is, as you say, you guys were already doing disaster films, and this film gets lumped in with that series of disaster films. We can discuss that at some point, whether it is or isn't. I think the actual people that made the movie and were involved in the movie, most of them chafe against the whole disaster film categorization of this film as well, because it's not really a disaster film. Or if it is, it's kind of a disaster film in reverse, because you get the disaster element right up front. So it sets the stage for the threat of the rest of the movie, kind of thing. But the other reason is, as you say, it's 4th of July adjacent. This is an almost annual rewatch for me on the 4th of July, just because much like Jaws itself, has a 4th of July connection. This one does, because the exciting climax of the film is all related to the 4th of July. You know, there's a brand new exciting roller coaster that's debuting, that's under threat in the movie on the 4th of July. So it's not exactly, a rah-rah patriotic film, but it's connected to the 4th of July in that aspect. And yeah, I dig this one out and rewatch it almost every 4th of July, or, in relation to that, because that's just when I remember it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I need to watch Roller Coaster again. So it was one of those I thought would make a good episode.
I'd never seen this before, and I was really excited to. I watched it. I ended up watching it twice because I wanted to. I really had got the first viewing. I knew where I was at and had all my notes and everything, but I'm like, I kind of want to watch it again just for, to kind of get past the initial viewing piece of it. And there's so much to enjoy about this. There is, and we're going to really have to talk about it being a disaster movie versus a thriller, because so much of the thriller aspect of this is what I enjoy. This is an example of how you craft a compelling villain. And there's such logic in this film that as far as that makes that villain so captivating, that there's a few sequences where almost the agents looking for him are almost bumbling, and I'll share them when we're in there, where I'm almost want to smack him upside the head, because this what I love about this film is just how gripping it is. And there's one sequence on a tower in particular where I'm sitting here, I'm like, you said you were watching, how are you not catching this? And that's few and far between in this film. I mean, as far as what's going on, because there's very few times where I'm not in that gripping moment of watching what's going on. So when there are those weird, tiny little illogic moments, they bug me just because of how well crafted this film is. This one was a joy from 70. I don't know how I missed this one. I feel like this is something that I should have seen long before now. And I'm really glad you suggested it, because I think there's a great conversation to be had here on what made up this one.
Well, I'm going to start off with addressing Scott's thoughts about the disaster film aspect of it. And I'm going to tell you, I agree with you. I think this got lumped in as a disaster film because those were popular at the time. And I think maybe not the producers of the film may not have agreed with that, but the marketing people probably thought, oh, that's the way to go, because, we'll sell more tickets if people think it's a disaster movie. It really is more of a 1970s police procedural or crime procedural, it's probably a better way to say it, than it is a disaster movie. It definitely has a 1970s feel about it. The way it's paced, the way it's edited, the cinematography, the music. I mean, we'll talk about all of those things. But yeah, this does not deserve to be lumped in with disaster films, because I think you're pigeonholing it then into something where it's not really, you're pigeonholing it on something that it isn't, basically, in my opinion.
I think part of that reason that it gets lumped in with them is that it was produced by Jennings Lang, who I believe had an involvement with the other big disaster films that happened right around that same time. So I think there's that connection as well. I first saw this, to my memory anyway. I know I never saw it in the theater or at the drive-in or anything like that. To my memory, my first time and my first several times seeing it were on network television. I seem to remember this one being one of those like weekend, like Sunday afternoon movies on WPIX. out of New York. And the reason that memory really sticks with me is because, as Paul said, it is kind of a police procedural in a lot of ways. And I think that part of that's because of who directed it, and who, you know, had an involvement with writing the movie. My understanding is they had, done a lot of like Columbo and stuff like that for TV. But I remember it being on network TV because the first time I ever got to see it on VHS, when they released it on VHS, and heard the language in it, which isn't much. I think George Segal says son of a bitch a couple of times, but the first time he said it, it really kind of surprised me, because this, for whatever reason, was one of those movies that I tape recorded, you know, audio tape recorded, as a kid, and just would listen to, like, you know, Star Wars and other, you know, films that I recorded that way. And so it's just inscribed in my brain. And the moment where, what's his name? Richard Widmark's character, Hoyt, when Hoyt and his men come to see, Harry in at his house to tell him that, you know, they want him to come to Virginia at the bomber's request. And he says, the son of a bitch just called me on network TV. He said, stupid bum. And he says it really funny, because I don't even think it's George Segal saying it, because he said it really funny. He said something like, the stupid bum. He sounds like a 30s gangster or something. He goes, stupid bum just called me. So the first time hearing that, you know, the way it was intended, or the theatrical way, kind of surprised me. It's like, oh, that's different. So that's why I know that, you know, I discovered the film through you know, the network TV. But the reason this one probably fell through the cracks for you, Sean, is that it got absolutely buried when it came out by a little indie film that came out just prior to it, Star Wars. Star Wars just, you know.
I'm gonna interrupt you for a moment, because it's not even just Star Wars. I was looking at that. This movie, I don't have that page up, but it was made on a budget of about $9 million, and it only made like $8 million.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, what was it competing with besides Star Wars? So I just did a quick Google search for top June 1977 box office performers. We have The Deep, which was a big hit at the time. We have Exorcist 2, The Heretic, which is one of the worst movies of all time, but made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. We have Star Wars. We have Smokey and the Bandit, Annie Hall, Night Fever, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Spy Who Loved Me, Pumping Iron. I mean, that's like, you know, how is a movie like this going to make a dime with that, competing with that? The only reason people went to this is because those were sold out and they were at the theater already.
Maybe you bump your movie to 1978, I guess.
Yeah, so it just got absolutely buried. You know, it just got completely lost in the shuffle. And it's one of those movies where most everybody that I'm aware of that has seen it has discovered it, you know, well beyond its theatrical run, you know, either through television or HBO or what have you, or a lot of people haven't ever discovered it. So I'm hoping maybe this will reach, you know, a new audience where, you know, they've never heard of it or they never discovered it and that sort of thing. That said, let's say right up front, we're probably going to be spoilery for this. So, you know, if you haven't ever seen the movie and you're interested in it, go check it out before listening to this episode in completion, because I sure wouldn't want to give away the ending, because it deserves to be watched and discovered on its own.
So the first thing that jumps out at me, well, I'm going to give a little stream of consciousness, but it almost felt to me like I was watching a TV movie. It didn't, you know, I think the big difference about this movie that made it theatrical was that they put the surround sound element on it. And there wasn't quite enough roller coaster moments to justify the surround sound for me. You know, because it was presented as a procedural. You know, we got a lot of things going on with there's the bomber and they're trying to figure out what he's doing and how he's doing it and where to go after him and all of that. And that, to me, should really be the crux of this movie. This movie is not really that big on spectacle. And I think for surround sound, you need spectacle. This is more of a thinking man's movie. And it's paced that way. It's got a slow 1970s pace to it as it builds up and it builds up suspense. A lot of the advertising in this said something to the effect of like a Hitchcockian thriller. And I would love to see this story had it been directed by Hitchcock. I think it would have stepped it up and it might have made it a classic.
I think one of the areas where, though, I really enjoyed the use of sound in this was music. As far as setting atmosphere and tone and sound effects. When you're those opening carnival sequences, the way they use music, whether the da-na-da-na-da-na-da-na-da-na, then it mixes in that carnival music and adding this build to what he was going to do. I do think sound was used very effectively there, more than it being a part of the actual roller coaster moments. It was the music leading into following our killer. And
the score, not the Foley sound.
Right. I felt like the score did a very, very good job of what I like in like horror thrill from the late 60s, early 70s, you know, that kind of stuff. Actually, if I go into things like The Omen, which music and all of that, I think, was just as scary as the film itself. I think it's one of the scariest films of all time. For me personally, and music does so much of that. In that, this one, I thought they did a really great job of giving you the feel that you were at a carnival with the way that they mixed it in with the thriller music that was building you to what was going to be happening. I think this is an example where sound, I think, was essential in driving part of the story. That's not taking anything away from the actors and what they were doing to portray those sequences, but they had the benefit besides very talented portrayals, because I felt like the killer was great in this. It was Timothy Bottoms as the killer, and I thought he was fantastic. When he came on the screen, he was captivating, portrayed this idea of he's socially off, but you see how he blends into a crowd. Like, he is not somebody that you would notice in a crowd, which is really important in this, that he doesn't look like an actor separated from the people in the crowd. He looks like somebody that could blend in his actions, the way that he's carrying himself. There were some clever choices made with him and how he's dressed, his performance, that you get why nobody would notice him. And he would, yep, he'd be like a chameleon. He's not Waldo. Sometimes when you do a killer in these thriller movies, they stand out and you're like, how do they not know that that guy is right there? He was one of the carnival goers in the presentation. We, though, knowing that we're supposed to be focused on him, see his odd behaviors, his antisocial behaviors, things that are going on throughout all this. And I loved like that portrayal. But sound for me was so much the soundtrack driving this. I actually would have loved to see it how it originally was intended in a theatrical venue that like takes advantage of how it was shot, just to see how the soundtrack would have played, because I'm thinking that's more of what you got out of it in that setting at the time than anything else, than the roller coaster sequences. And to your point, Paul.
Going to the score, usually we leave the score towards the end of the episode, but we could talk about it a little bit early, because one of the things, while I was watching it, I'm not familiar with the composer, Lalo Schifrin, but while I was watching it, I was thinking, this reminds me a little bit of the score in Dirty Harry, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And then when I looked him up afterwards, he did the score for Dirty Harry. So I thought that was interesting that I made that connection. And he apparently, you know, he did a lot of movies of that era that are well known. He did the Dirty Harry series. He did Cool Hand Luke. He did Enter the Dragon. He did the Amityville Horror. So, I mean, he had more of a body of work than I had any clue about, because I'm not really the huge score guy, but it was, I thought it was very cool that I actually made the connection before I read up on him.
as your score guy, pretty much my extent of knowledge of Lalo Schifrin before doing a little bit of homework for this episode was that he did the score, he composed the theme for Mission Impossible, which is, you know, one of the classic TV themes of all time. But beyond that, until I looked it up, I didn't know he did Dirty Harry and all these other ones. I own one Lalo Schifrin soundtrack in my collection, and that's Roller Coaster. But I think, his music is probably the number one thing that that made me a fan of this movie and made me, kind of fall in love with the movie right from being a kid. And probably the reason I recorded, audio recorded the film off of television was because I loved the music. The music is the most effective thing in this movie. I heard it speculated. I watched several different things, making of videos and the commentary that came on the Blu-ray, which I have, which, by the way, you don't need to waste your time with that commentary. It's really not very good. It's, you talk about us tangenting sometimes in our recordings, Paul. These guys tangent all. They start off talking about Roller Coaster and end up way off in left field by the end of it. But anyway, somebody at some point and something I was listening to speculated that this may have been Lalo Schifrin's tribute, homage, whatever you want to call it, to Bernard Herrmann, who had passed away about a year before the movie came out. And I can kind of go with that because it is very psycho in a lot of ways. It's very Hitchcockian. I think the score, more than anything else, may be the thing that gets this movie referred to as Hitchcockian, because it's the music, it's the use of strings. Strings were heavily used by Herrmann for Psycho, the whole E-E-E that everybody knows, but also, when you listen to the rest of that score, it's mostly strings and dark music. And that works so effectively in this. There's the string, it starts right out with that at the very beginning when, the bomber is on the pier, observing the roller coaster. We get the Hitchcockian psycho-esque strings right out of the gate. But the other thing that made me absolutely fall in love with the music of this movie is the I'm not sure how well you would describe it. To me, it's kind of like calliope music or like carousel music. Yes. The circus music. When you initially hear it, you think it's the music of the park, and then it goes dark and you realize, oh wait, this is actually theme music of this is the movie's theme music, carnival music. But dark carnival music, and it really works effectively, especially in the transition to the money drop at the very beginning of that sequence when it transitions to early dawn at that park as it opens for the day where the money drop is supposed to happen. Listen to that carnival music start as sort of traditional carnal and then go very dark and very sinister. And it's, oh man, it's so good. It's so effective. This soundtrack is the one I paid the most for in my life. Cause this was a holy grail for me for a long, long time. It just was never released, or at least not that I could ever find. And then sometime in the 90s, I think right around the time Amazon or some online service came around, I found it for, I want to say it was 50 or 60 bucks. It was a Japanese CD release that I had to pay for. Oh. I paid a small fortune, much more than I would ever pay for anything else, but I just wanted it so bad. It's a pretty good CD, but it still doesn't have all of the incidental music of the movie, and it has a lot of like kind of weird stuff. Just really, really effective use of the music. Also the sequence where the men, the servicemen are on, walking the track, you know, under the guise of putting bunting on the track, but they're actually looking for the bomb. You have two pieces of music playing at the exact same time, two very disparate pieces of music. You have what's called tension rock on the soundtrack, which is kind of a rock and roll theme type of thing. And then you have those strings come back again, and they compete and complement each other at the same time. And it's really what something that could have been just, it could have come off as just pure noise and headache inducing totally works. It's so well done. Just really, really effective use of sound and music.
That sequence you're talking about with them on the tracks where the maintenance workers are up there, example of how music and the action in the film just made a made something into feel like a day-to-day task that these men do in maintenance. Because there were so many of them up there, there was a sense of this claustrophobic space and danger just in the fact that you shouldn't have that many people up there at the same time trying to compete with where their whole handhelds all up. Hand holding is and things like that, especially moving around with the kind of speed that they were. I loved the fact that, I mean, some of it you saw coming, you know, I saw the guy falling and, you know, and eventually, you know, having to get caught and that type of thing. But I loved the fact that it felt like these are logical things that should be happening. There's some immense logic in this film that I think adds to the sense of danger. And that sequence is one that, when you, if you put that on a page by numbers, it should be boring. It absolutely was not. Yeah. And that really should be like, let's put a bunch of maintenance workers on a track looking for a bomb. That was gripping. Every bit of that was gripping. And that was an example of where music and acting and numbers and everything they did as far as cinematography on that made that an absolutely gripping sequence.
And I think, you know, when we talked about, well, when I mentioned earlier about them saying this was Hitchcockian, I think that sequence had the Hitchcock feel to it, because you know they're up there, you know they're going for the bomb, and he's out in the crowd, you know where he is, but, you know, but they don't, and he's looking around, and you're wondering, oh, is he going to see them? Is he going to figure out what they're doing? Is he going to set off this bomb? That is a very, very Hitchcockian scenario that you have there, and as long as it's presented correctly, it is creating a level of suspense. And then, you know, and we, you mentioned the spoilers, you know, that when they do discover it and then he sees them and, you know, that whole bit, I don't want to go too much into what the spoilers are and what happens there, but, you know, I thought it was well done, but I still sit here saying, I wonder, like, if Hitchcock had been around to direct this, what would he have done in that sequence? What would he have done differently? And I think it would have changed, in my personal opinion, to a very good moment to possibly a great moment. And I think that would have been interesting to see.
I don't know. I mean, this is spoilery. So again, you know, those listening, if you don't want to be spoiled, then you know, fast forward a little bit. But to your point, I think the buildup in that sequence to the moment when the bomber, the young man, whatever you want to call him, he's credited as the young man in the credits. They never do give him a name. When the young man realizes what's happening and he pulls out the detonator, and you see it's always methodical with him. He pulls it out. He has the little activator. He has the antenna. He has to pull out all that. He does all that while he's watching them up there, and he hits that button at the exact moment the guy cuts the wire. To me, that is one of cinema's great, oh my Lord, how close did they come moments. I mean, it's a heart stopper for just a moment. I really like that. But back to what Sean was saying real quick about the music, there was a video, I don't know if you guys ever saw it, this is quite some time ago now, but there was a video somebody did of showing how effective movie music is when it is at its most effective. And it was things like the throne room sequence at the end of Star Wars without the music. Some scene from Jaws, I forget which one, but some scene from Jaws, I think it was the dock where the guys are out fishing with the pot roast, and the you know, you never see the shark or anything. Everything is in the threat of the music. And they showed that scene with just regular ambient noise and no music. I think you could do the same thing. You could take that maintenance worker scene from this movie. If you were to watch that movie, that sequence, I don't know how long it runs. It feels very long, but say it runs 10 minutes. Watch that entire sequence with just whatever the ambient noise was of the scene, no music. You'd watch that and go, this is the most boring thing. It's just some guys. It's just some maintenance guys working. It's the music that entirely drives that. And I'm watching that and my palms are getting sweaty, you know, and it's the music that's doing that. I love that. One other thing you had said that brought something to mind to me was how the young man is able to weave himself around these people through the entire movie unnoticed. That was something I picked up on as a kid. I think this may be the first time, when I watched this as a kid, that may be the first time it ever occurred to me that you could brush past important people or important things in your life completely unnoticed. And it got me to thinking, you know, how many times had that happened in my life where I may have been in the same place or maybe walked right by somebody that I would later meet in my life that would be important in my life type of thing. You know, we both happened to be at, you know, the same venue at the same time, but never knew it type of thing. And it got me to thinking about that. And that became a thing. I don't know if you guys ever watched Lost when Lost was on TV. They did that a lot in that in flashbacks, they would show that these characters that you had come to know that were important to the narrative that was going on, they had brushed past each other several times over the course of their lives and never knew it. And I love stuff like that. And this movie makes really effective use of that. Probably most effective when the young man is leaving the hotel room after having just bugged it, disguised as a hotel staff. He and Harry walk right past each other as Harry's getting out of the elevator, and they actually even exchange a glance. They both look right at each other and keep going. I love that. And there's a lot of that in this movie.
Never naming him is a brilliant choice.
Yep.
So often we're used to the villain being this named enigma, and the name kind of drives who they are and what they do. When he's at the shooting gallery, that's shooting gallery sequence very early on, and the attendant walks up to him and recognizes he has some skills, you know, shows the tattoo and trying to connect with the man with a potential past history. You know, this is where we get to see the social, like, I'm not really here a part of all this, because he just smiles and walks away. I mean, he just won a bear and there's zero acknowledgement of that. Yeah. You know, he's doing these activities to blend in, but he is not, he's not friends with anybody. He's not socially connected with anybody. There is no emotional connection to anybody he's encountering. He's really passing time. Later on, we see the bear in the garbage can.
Yeah.
You know, I thought such, you know, great that like these things that he's doing mean nothing. They're all about inserting himself into a community, weaving in and out through the community so he can accomplish his goal. And even the part when, like, he's going to actually flip the detonator and there's that kid that's throwing a tantrum. And it's like, you can almost feel his annoyance of, kid, get out of here. I got to blow this up right now at the right time or else none of this is going to work. But I loved you mentioned gripping parts of it with the maintenance workers. That was a gripping part of, is he going to be able to pull this off or not? I loved the subtle pieces of he can't be seen doing this, because then the illusion of I am a part of this crowd goes away. So I love that we got to see how careful he was to make sure that when he actually took action, nobody would be able to see. I saw a guy pull out a remote and push a button.
Right. And
those pieces of the film, tiny details, I think are what made this such a compelling villain. Through his actions instead of like some name that like was driving us. It didn't do some of the usual tropes that I think other films were like are more used to with villains. And I loved that about him in this. It's what they didn't do that I think was so effective, and how they used the things that they did do to blend him in. The camouflage I thought was great.
I have to say, in my opinion, I thought Timothy Bottoms' performance and the way he was presented was actually the highlight of this film. I thought that was the best part of the film. I thought he the way he maintained kind of a monotone, he never got emotional about anything. He was that created more of a, you know, he underplayed it, which made it more threatening in my opinion, which it often does. And but they don't always, you know, it doesn't always work. Sometimes we talked recently, actually a movie that's not a review that's not coming out for a while yet, but we talked about a performance in the movie The Silent Partner and how every once in a while it ramped up and it went over the top a little bit, and that's where it felt threatening, but it just kind of lost its creepiness when that happened. And I guess you'll get to that review in a couple of months when it comes out. but you know, in this one, that never happened. He never seemed to get emotional. He never like, you know, everything was calculated. And I think that was where he was threatening, because he seemed so intelligent and so calculating. You know, the George Segal character, there was a little bit of stereotyping or you know, just which you could expect. You know, he's the smartest man in the room, and everybody else is dismissing his ideas because they know better than him in their minds. And meanwhile, he's the only one who's on the right track with this. You know, that was a little bit cliche in a lot of ways, but it still was presented well enough because the actors, you know, who were doing it, George Segal and Richard Widmark, were of a good enough quality to get away with cliche to a large extent. Again, you know, there were moments in it. I'm going to give you, you know, my negative take on it was there were moments on it where the pacing slowed down a little too much for me. When the young man is running him through his paces in the park, and he's got to go on every ride, and we're just seeing each ride and whatever. And I think some of that was done for the benefit of, you know, we're doing this in Sensoround, so let's show him on rides so that we can, you know, vibrate the chairs in the theater. I thought they kind of overdid it and slowed it down a little too much at that point. But other than that, I thought it was a suspenseful procedural, and I thought that's where it got its strength from, the characterization of these people.
The one thing I did like about that sequence, though, was this idea that he knew everything they were going to be doing, and he was watching them. The only issue, I guess my irritation during that sequence is minor, very minor. When he was on that tower, and you got the guy up there saying, I'm watching it, he was up there with those binoculars entirely too long for how careful he was everywhere else. If there's one area where I'm like, you should have moved him or done something with him a little differently there, because we had seen such brilliance in how careful he'd been, it stood out to me. So didn't ruin the sequence for me by any stretch, but I was keeping track of how long he was up there with the binoculars, and I'm like, this just feels too long. Not moving George Segal's character around a lot, it was the fact that he stood up there with the binoculars. You've got this guy wandering around. Wouldn't you at some point in time go, why is this dude still standing here? That in and of itself should seem odd in what he was doing. That was the only logic flaw where I'm like, that one, maybe he's standing out a little bit more than he should be with how brilliant the camouflage has been otherwise. But I did like that in his movement of George Segal, whether it was too long or not, I mean, I get that point. But I liked what they were doing there, where he was moving him around like a chess piece, because he knew what they were going to be doing in order to track him with the, you know, with the fact that he was mic'd, the fact that there would be backup opportunities, the fact that they were watching him all over the place. Everything he was doing was for the purpose of trying to get that money without being caught, which is what they were trying to do. And I did like that thrilling part of it. But there were parts of it where it took too long. And I felt like the tower piece was a great example where it took too long with the binoculars. But that, again, in a film where I feel like they set up such a brilliant thriller killer, that's why it stands out, because of the fact that the logic works so well everywhere else that when it didn't, it stood out.
I agree with you about him being up on the tower. That always kind of stands out to me. I don't know if it ever did as a kid, you know, watching it, but now when I watch it, that always stands out a bit, like, you know, because he would have had to have been up there through pretty much, you know, the whole thing up until the end where he actually, you know, gets the money. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, that nobody ever noticed him seems a little, especially, you know, he's got the earpiece in, which mm-hmm. we, you know, modern audiences could watch that and never think a thing of it. We all walk around with earbuds in our ears, but back in the 1970s, that would be a pretty unusual thing. The same thing occurs to me when Hoyt and his men leave Harry's house, apartment, whatever that is, and they're driving down the road. They drive right past young man sitting in his car on the phone. Car phones were not a thing back then. I mean, if you had a car phone, you stood out. You know, you were rich, you were a spy, whatever the case may be. It was not a common thing for people to have a telephone in their car. So that always stands out to me just a little bit. Like, how did they not notice that? Or did they notice and just never not think, you know? But there's a lot of that in the movie. I kind of like the aspect of the police being, I don't know if bumbling's quite the right word. It's more of just overconfident, because Hoyt right out of the gate, and you can see the look on Harry's face when he does it. Hoyt is, we'll get him. You know, he's just completely dismissive of this guy. Like, oh, he's just another crazy person. And, you know, he's just another man for us to bring in. And Harry gives him that little sideways glance, like, you're underestimating this guy. And we immediately see that in the whole money drop sequence. He's got everything figured out. The first thing he tells Harry, take the mic off, you know, and then he knows later on that they gave him a backup, because Harry says, oh, what? He goes, what signal? You made me take the mic off. And he goes, they gave you a backup. So he's clever. He's way ahead of them on every step of this. And I really, that's what makes it enjoyable to me, is that he's continually underestimated through the entire film, except by Harry. And I think the element that works the absolute best in this movie beyond the music is the rapport, the relationship between Harry and the young man. Mm-hmm. Harry has a grudging admiration for him, a grudging respect for him. You know, he's quick to point out, you know, he says right to him, you know, I'm not a fan, you kill people. But at the same rate, he respects his intelligence. And I like that. And the young man, I don't know that he necessarily respects Harry, but I think there's a certain level of, you know, Widmark continually refers to, when he's talking to Harry, refers to the bomber as your friend or your pal. When Harry shoots him towards the end of the movie, that look on his face, to me, I interpret as betrayal. He feels betrayed by Harry. He gives Harry a look like, I can't believe you did that. I love that, because it shows some sort of a thing was going on between these two men, some sort of not a friendship or anything, but just they had a relationship, and now it's broken for good. And he realizes it in that moment.
I like what you're saying about there being a question of whether or not he respects Harry. He certainly, from that sequence where the room was mic'd up and he heard Harry and recognized Harry was the smartest guy in the room, he started keying on him afterwards. And right. And what he was trying to do in jumping Harry through the hoops and having Harry under control with him being the point person is making sure that the smartest guy in the room is somebody I'm watching at all times.
Yeah. So he respected his intelligence too. Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the things, using Harry as a foil in that. I think that's part of the logic that works in the film. Why did he do that? He heard right away from that beginning sequence, this is the guy I need to make sure I know where he's at all. Yeah.
Time. Need to keep him isolated. Yeah.
That little song and dance that he did up there, he's got him under control, because he feels like, I understand the procedural process of these other people because they're not taking me as seriously as this guy is. This guy, on the other hand, I need to control him so I can do what I need to do. And I loved that part of this.
Yeah.
With how that all worked out, there was a strong logic to it.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that's true. Paul, you're very quiet.
You know, I enjoyed watching this movie, but I don't have a lot of a lot of commentary on it, to be honest with you. It was just, it did, and I guess this is going to sound negative, and it's not meant to be, but it did have kind of a traditional feel to it. There were some, you know, I hate to use the word cliche, but there were some formulaic aspects to this and how it progressed. And I like a lot of the little touches that we've talked about. What Sean was just saying is absolutely, you know, it's absolutely true. You have to be watching it kind of closely to catch that, or you might not even realize it's going on, which, you know, I appreciate the subtlety of that. I appreciated the subtlety of the performances by Timothy Bottoms and George Segal. I appreciated seeing a young Helen Hunt as his daughter and saying, oh, what the heck is she doing there? But you know, there are elements of this that did feel a little bit formulaic and cliche, not necessarily in a negative way. I don't, you know, it's not like, oh, I looked at this and it was, you know, I couldn't be bothered and I picked up my iPad and started doing stuff. That was not the case. I was interested in it and I was watching it, but it overall, it had a feel for me almost like a really good episode of Columbo or something like that, because it didn't feel like a theatrical movie to me. Despite the surround sound and despite the fact that I'm watching it on a really big set, it felt to me like a TV movie with very good elements to it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say this is terrible. But it didn't stand out to me as you know, oh, this is something that I'm going to keep dwelling on over time. I'm not gonna be doing your I watch it every year on the 4th of July thing. I'm gonna continue to watch Jaws every year on the 4th of July, and I'm not adding this to my watching list. If I'm flipping through the channels, yeah, I'm probably stopping on this for a little while if I see it's on, which unfortunately is unlikely. I don't remember the last time I saw that this was on a TV station. But you know, it's a good, but not really standout movie for me.
I have a strong argument why this is not a TV movie, because here's what a TV movie does not have. A young Steve Guttenberg with really big hair. I had hair in the 70s. It was proof to me that I was adopted, because I was, and I do not have my dad's hair, but Steve Guttenberg had that big hair when he came in. It was great. I really liked it.
The strange thing about that was I watched it, I saw Steve Guttenberg, and I was like, oh my God, because a week before, for the first time ever, and Sean, we had mentioned this when we saw each other, I watched the movie The Boys from Brazil, which Steven Guttenberg has a part in, which I had no clue, because I knew that was Gregory Peck and Laurence Olivier, but I had no idea Steve Guttenberg had a significant role in it. So all of a sudden, Steve Guttenberg's all over my TV set. I prefer to have him hunt all over my TV set.
There's a number of you know bit parts like that, and you know, people that you may recognize, or you know, the one that always stands out to me, because I always catch his voice whenever I hear his voice right away. I'm like, oh, that's who that is Michael Bell as the manager of Magic Mountain at the end of the movie. You know, he's probably most famous in geek circles. He was the voice of Zan, one of the Wonder Twins. He was Groppler Zorn in the very first episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. But I just love that guy. But as soon as he opens his mouth and speaks, I always recognize Michael Bell's voice, because it always just sounds like Zan to me. So I got a kick out of that. But there's a number of actors, you know, all littered through. There's a guy I don't know the actor's name. I never bothered to look it up, but one of the maintenance workers is one of the hockey players in Slapshot with Paul Newman.
There's also Craig Wesson, who was, he's probably most famous for being in Body Double, but the thing I remember most is The Stuntman, if you ever saw that movie.
I'm not sure.
He just plays a hippie in this.
Was he the one that was... he and his girlfriend were riding in like the last car. Is that the guy? Because he went on to be in what was it, Ghost Story? He was
in
Ghost Story. Is that the guy?
I'm gonna look and see if he was in Ghost Story. Ghost Story was what, about 1980,
I think. 80, 81.
Ghost Story.
Yep. Yeah. That's you, Not that it's an enticement, but you get to see his little Watson in that movie.
Well, that's not an enticement at all. That's an enticement for me to not watch it.
Let's see what else I got on this one. Oh, speaking of characters, I spotted three, possibly all four are in the movie, and I just didn't find the fourth one, but I did spot, and it's a blink and you miss it. You actually probably are best off using frame per frame, but in the moments in King's Dominion, the second park in the film, the money drop park, in the sequences, mostly when Harry is up in the sky ride and he looks out into the crowd, in some of those crowd scenes, you can spot three of the four banana splits, which just amuses me no end. I really got a kick out of that.
Weagle, Snork, Trooper, and Bingo.
Is Snork the elephant?
Yes.
He's the one I couldn't find. Yeah, he's probably in there, but I just could never see him. I did also see Yogi Bear as a blink and you miss him character as well. But yeah, I got a kick out of that. I can only assume that must be the same park that was in the beginning of the Banana Splits credits.
What would have made this just a little bit more fascinating for me is if it was done in the era of the theme park instead of the amusement park.
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up because that was one of my things. I think that was one of the things that's always made me really like this movie is I love the premise, the vulnerability of the amusement park industry. And I'm with you, Paul. I don't know that I necessarily want to see this film remade, but I had an idea a long time ago of a sequel. It's a shame that George Segal's now, he's long dead now, but I always thought, what if they were to have done a sequel, say 20 years later, sometime in the 90s, and it's son of young man, son of bomber from this movie, right?
That's the name of the movie.
He's grown up. What's that? I'm sorry.
That's the name of the sequel, Son of Young Man.
but he's grown up without a dad. He's got a grudge against Harry Calder because he blames Calder for his father's death. And now he's going to do the same thing, but he's doing it in a modern setting. And what's the modern amusement park? It's a theme park. So you've got, I'm sure they could never get Disney to cooperate with something like this, but you've got, say, Universal Studios or, one of the more modern, now theme parks and doing kind of the same thing. I think that could be interesting because it's a more recognizable environment to modern audiences that have grown up going to theme parks.
To do a fictional theme park because I don't think Universal would go along with it either because these places would be afraid that they're scaring off patrons by having a movie like this. I'm surprised that these amusement parks allowed it.
Right.
We actually should talk about that part really quick because I do think his extortion is brilliant as well. Because you're attacking an industry that would have every bit a reason to say, we can't let people know this is happening.
Right.
People do, it's going to pull people away from our parks. So that added to his camouflage element in all of this, which I thought was great that, as a premise goes. And I'm with you on it's too bad it wasn't in the theme park era because I think you could even play with that further. But I love that was a part of it. These are companies that own multiple amusement parks. There is a huge financial implication of this implodes. We are now losing millions of dollars, and whatever it was in the 70s. But, this is a huge entertainment industry at a time where they're not competing with, to put it in perspective, they're not competing with our tablets and our things like that we have today. So destination theme parks and things like that, local theme parks, local amusement parks, I should say, were much more prevalent. We had them here in Ohio. We had Geauga Lake, which had SeaWorld connected to it and things like that. The local parks that couldn't survive as the bigger theme park era began, were a huge amusement era. That was where people were going for entertainment when we had three channels and things. I loved that feel of this would cost them an immense amount of money if this came out, which added to his camouflage as well.
And if you think about it, if you did it in a modern setting, in an amusement park or theme park, rather, and there are a tremendous number now of thrill rides at these theme parks that are internal. You know, if you think about, you know, Space Mountain or the Guardians ride or the Harry Potter rides, you know, you're going inside and you're in a building and you're doing all of this in a much more enclosed space, which I think deftly directed could create a claustrophobia that would also go along with the fear of the explosion, that I think you could really make this into a more thrilling, you know, circumstance, for lack of a better word.
The other thing you could touch on in a sequel with this one would be, how do you deal with the Instagram YouTuber era, you know, where people have created a industry around promoting themselves based on that? How do you keep this under wraps?
Right. I think that could be the thrill element of a more modern take. I like where Paul's thinking of the internal, but what to me, what makes this horrific and makes it something where the owners are almost immediately unanimous in we got to pay, is the fact of that, you know, the one disaster, you know, and I'm saying this in air quotes, the one disaster element, you know, that we do get in the very beginning with the roller coaster derailment, it's very public. I mean, everybody that's there knows exactly what's happening. If you did it, as you say, and you do it with an internal ride, there wouldn't quite be that horror element to the crowd. You know, the whole rest of the park may not even know anything's happening.
Well, that depends on the extent of the explosion and the extent of damage that it creates. It could take an internal ride and make it an external ride.
That's a really good point. But yeah,
I think also, if you know, and I agree with you, don't remake this movie, but maybe use the premise to create a new story of a similar idea. And the opposition that the Harry character is going to receive could be by the theme park owners, who don't want these threats to become public because they're terrified that they're going to lose their patronage. And you know, they don't want to close down, and the 4th of July is coming and they have a huge event planned. I mean, you can make a fictional amusement park real easy. It would be real easy to say, oh, here's the ride that's based on this fictional movie. I mean, you see things like that all the time, and it's just a matter of creating the appearance of a ride similar to the ones you see at Disney and Universal. So right. That isn't really a problem at all in my mind, but you can make it, I think, because of the nature of the internal rides too, you know, things like Soarin', they're different. They're not all just throwing you around on a roller coaster, which the roller coaster, I think, is the primary type of ride. And, the, you know, again, the Harry Potter ride, the Guardians of the Galaxy ride, there's plenty of ones that you can work with as concepts to kind of try and steal, but you're going to have different kinds of rides now that you didn't have back then, and you could be more creative in what the bomber, the young man, is doing to threaten these rides. And I think there's a lot that you could play with if you were the screenwriter on something like this. And I think to kind of bring it back to this movie, I think that lends us to what the strength of this movie is if you think about it from a modern perspective, and then you watch this movie, you don't get mired down in the 1970s-ishness of it, you know, because it is paced differently and the rides are different than what we see today. So you kind of have to just place yourself in that era. I think that's what you need to do, because the era is different now. I think a thrill movie based on the current era would be great, but we have a thrill movie based on, and you know, I got to take that back. It's not really a thrill movie. We have a suspense movie based on the way things were back then. And I think that if you put yourself in that era and you think about the way things were that in that era, it works. But I would love to see it modernized anyway.
I have something I thought was funny at the end, but I have to spoil the ending. So for people listening to this, big disclaimer, if you have not watched this, just make sure you watch it first. But at the very end of the movie, he dies because the car hits him from the roller coaster. And I love that the movie ends with almost immediately the people lining up to get back on said ride after somebody was just hit by the car. I'm not had a wet nap ready or what was going on or what they did as far as getting that ride going. But I was laughing hysterically at the end of that. Didn't ruin the, it's nothing that I don't mean to like in a negative way on the film, but I just thought it was funny. Like, oh yeah, guy just died. Let's get on there again. Come
that
on.
That may be the most realistic moment of the entire movie, honestly. Yes. That's exactly that, at least from a modern perspective. Yeah, that's modern.
I think there are people out there who have, you know, a phobia about going on rides, and they just don't. But I think that the people that do go on rides are often way too trusting, and I think that's an example of it. Because, you know, in hindsight, I look at these like these traveling amusement venues that they have. You know, they'll be, oh, they're gonna have this fair in this place for this weekend, and then they're going to move on, and they have roller coaster type rides that they put up, you know, prefabricated, that they put them up in, you know, a day, and now you're on it, and you're thinking, you know, when you seriously think about it, what are the safety precautions on these things?
Right.
You know, it's that's different than Universal and Disney, where, you know, they're under constant scrutiny, and even then there's still some element of things can fail. But when you're dealing with these things, I mean, the danger, the risk factor has to be multiplied just a lot. I don't know what kind of number.
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, I'm loath to criticize the film. I really enjoy this one a lot. But that is something that that occurred to me. I was watching one of the making of things, and apparently the guy in the King's Dominion sequence, that was the real manager of the park, the kind of chubby guy sitting behind the desk. He only has just a couple of lines. You only see him just a couple of times, but he was the real park manager of that park at the time. And he said that he agreed to participate in the film and let them use his park because they allowed him to kind of freshen up their script a little bit. And his big objection was the way both the parks and most especially the park employees were originally written was that they were basically like drunken, skeezy carnies. And he really objected to that. And he wanted to portray, you know, he wanted them portrayed more like how he felt that their industry was, you know, what the industry was going for. I think the mistake that they made, though, is you've got three distinct parks in the film. You've got Ocean View at the beginning, you've got King's Dominion in the middle, and you've got Magic Mountain at the end. So you have basically an old park, a middling park, you know, however old that one was, and then you've got what feels to be a brand new park, or at least a brand new attraction with the Great American Revolution, a brand new coaster's opening. I think what they should have done, Ocean View, just by the look of it being an old park and everything, I think that one should have been the Carney Park. It should have had your traditional, like you're saying, Paul, kind of that fly-by-night feel, you know, where they come in the middle of the night, they set everything up in a hurry. You kind of look at the rides and go, that looks fun, but, you know, you have that trepidation of getting on it because how safe is that really? Look at the guy that's running it. He looks like a bum or he looks like a drunk or, you know, like he's on drugs or whatever. And we've been to places like that. We all have. Everybody, I think that's the reason why Ray Bradbury picked that venue when he did Something Wicked This Way Comes is because we all have in the back, at least in the back of our mind, that little bit of fear of the carnival, because that's the nature of that business. So I think that very first park really could have reflected that a lot better instead of clean cut employees and, you know, everybody looking, you know, very professional. I think if it had more of that edge of this is a little sketch, I think that really could have played into the psychology behind the movie and behind the bomber first attacking that and the vulnerability of that industry, because we already have that sense of unease with those venues to begin with. It's ingrained in a lot of us anyway.
But there's a sense, and that I'm relating this to my life. When I was in my late teens, early 20s, me and my friends would make an annual trip over to Coney Island, which was not too far from where I lived, and we'd go on the Cyclone. And that was, you know, always a thrill. And there was an element of doing that where you say to yourself, this has been around forever. I trust that it's secure. But that as you're on it, it feels rickety and like it's going to fall apart. So you're kind of telling yourself, I trust that I'm going to get through this. But oh, my God, this is so rickety. And like you let that give you the thrill. So I do think there's an element of that with theme parks and even these fly-by-night amusement attractions where you're saying, oh, it's safe. But the fact that it doesn't feel safe is what the thrill is.
Right.
So you kind of have to kind of mesh those two and make it work for you, which is not easy to do necessarily, but people do it all the time. Right. I think there is that element of it. And I think, you know, sometimes the problem is when we trust and we shouldn't.
Right.
You know, with these, some of these, again, these fly by night places that Sean is apparently going to every weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. I will admit that I am the guy that will get on the ride that like you shouldn't get on. Just by the very nature of it. Like I feel like I should be walking up with tools and tightening things.
I'm at the point now that if we go to like a, you know, one of these weekend carnival places, I won't even go on a teacup ride.
Right.
Well, I will say as I've gotten older, teacup rides and I do not play as nice as they used to when I was younger, but I will go on like the roller coasters and things like that, that you probably, you're right. Like, what's keeping that car on there?
and just again, just from my own personal perspective, I won't go on a Ferris wheel. And my reason has nothing to do with the fact that I think it's going to fall apart. But I just always, I'm always fearful that as they're letting people get off of the Ferris wheel, I'm going to be up at the top while they're letting the people at the bottom do it. And I just don't like heights. And they're going to stop and leave me up at the top.
Right.
Rest.
Right.
I'm going something that has heights. I want that height to go by very quickly.
I go on the Ferris wheels. I will admit that when I'm on there and that thing's like swinging and all that, and you hear the rickety sound off of that, I'm like, is this okay? But I still get on it.
Yeah. And you know, to bring it kind of full circle back to what I was talking about earlier, Hitchcock had done things in amusement parks. You know, there was a change on the train that ends on the merry-go-round.
Oh, right.
You know, there's definitely stuff that Hitchcock could play with. And I think, boy, to see somebody of his directing abilities do a movie that we're talking about now with, you know, like the more modern take on this, that would be a movie I'd want to see.
Is the Cyclone where they trap and kill the monster at the end of Beast from 20,000 Fathoms?
I don't know. I've never seen the Beast from 20,000
Fathoms. Have you not? Oh, that needs to be a future episode right there. Yeah, I think just the fact that you've ridden that, because I'm pretty sure that is the coaster, just the fact you've been at that, that's cool to me. I think that's really neat. I sometimes forget that's a real place.
It's Coney Island. You don't get much more famous as far as beachfront amusement parks.
Right. Well, it's actually referenced in this. See, I think you hit on something because I was thinking
and
about
it. Yes, look up the movie. It is the Coney Island Cyclone.
Oh, okay. Cool.
So we will have to watch that. Interestingly, done in the 19, that came out in 1953, and I'm just looking at the cast, and it's got Michael Fox. Now, it's not Michael J. Fox, but okay.
That movie is probably the biggest, and we're getting far afield, but that movie is probably the biggest reason I was disappointed by Jurassic Park. Yes, I'm that one guy in the world that was disappointed by Jurassic Park, because Spielberg said very famously before it came out that that it was his attempt to remake The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and it is not by any stretch a remake of that movie.
And interestingly, and we'll stay far afield here, when I saw Jurassic Park in the movies, I was disappointed because I had read the book and the book was so thrilling to me that the movie didn't quite live up to it. But over time, I've come to love that movie. But when I first saw it, I was disappointed.
See, it's why I like the second one. I'm that one guy that likes the second movie, but I love the second movie because it kind of fulfilled that promise of being a monster rampage in the city, which is what Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
We're tangenting like crazy here, but I'm going to give you a little podcast history here. When I first started listening to podcasts and I discovered Two True Freaks, one of the things that I found that attracted me to that podcast was the fact that you and Chris kind of went against the tide on, it felt like everything, you know. Spider-Man 3 is getting bad reviews. We love Spider-Man 3. X-Men The Last Stand is getting bad reviews. We love X-Men The Last Stand. Dark Knight is getting positive reviews like crazy. We hate the Dark Knight. Just, everything I listened to seemed to go against the tide. And I didn't always agree with you, but I always liked your perspective on it. And it was one of the things that made me keep listening and eventually become a freak.
Well, I appreciate that, but unfortunately, I that reputation of being the contrarian has stuck, and it was never intentional. It's just my honest opinion of the movies we talked about. But no, you hit on something. I was trying to figure out, because I figured one of you guys might ask, you know, what was my interest or fascination with this movie? I've wondered that pretty much my whole life, because I'm not a roller coaster guy. I've never liked roller coasters. As a matter of fact, for many, many, many years, I had what I guess you could really label as a phobia of coasters. I had a girlfriend once who made me ride a coaster at Marineland in somewhere in Ontario. And I came off it hyperventilating. I mean, I was a freaking mess when I came off that ride. And she goes, "You love Roller Coaster," meaning this movie. We'd watched it together. And she's like, "You love them? I thought you loved Roller." And I was like, "No, I'm scared to death of them." But the thing was, you know, when I was a kid, very little, I forget how old I was, but, very little kid, I was on, it wasn't even a roller coaster, but in my mind, I think as a child, I just always associated it with coasters. It was one of those like little kiddie trains that would go through a park. This was at Lowry Park in Tampa, back when, you know, the more kiddie elements existed that are long gone now. But I was riding that ride with an aunt of mine, and it went through like a zoo or a petting farm or something like that. But anyway, it was a long circle around like this kiddie area. And it went through this barn-like structure that had doors that opened on either end. And additional cars had been added to the train for this particular trip or this day or whatever. And as the train was going through this barn, the ride operator hit the door, hit the button to close the door, forgetting that extra cars had been added to the train. So the door came down and damn near tore the head off of this lady who was in one of the last cars on the thing. I saw all this as a kid, and it traumatized me for the longest time, because my child mind associated it with amusement park rides. And so I was always like, why am I so enamored of this movie when I hate roller coasters and this? And I think that's it. I think it's that innate fear and distrust of amusement park rides, and I think that's what works. And again, I think they really could have played that up more, especially with the first one that we see that has very much that carny, you know, that traditional carny feel to it, of an older amusement park at the very beginning. But I also think that's why that derailment is so effective at the beginning, because that's, you know, a very public spectacle in that part of the movie.
All right. Are we at the point where we're going to rate it, or want to add any more notes?
I had a quick question for Sean. So you just got this on Blu-ray, you said, right?
Yes.
So how is your present? Because you have a different version of the Blu-ray than I have. So I'm just curious what yours, did it have like any extras or anything like that on it?
So I haven't got a chance to get to the extras, in all honesty. It had interviews with the writer and the theatrical trailer, so nothing like super crazy.
You know, does it have both versions of the movie or
did
it did? Oh, okay, cool. Which so one did you watch?
I'm not sure which of the two versions I watched. I grabbed the first version that I saw and I watched it twice, just for this purpose. I don't know I honestly, full disclosure, I don't know the difference between the two versions.
Runtime's
very similar.
It's about 13 seconds is what it works out to. So here's the funny thing. I want to know, how many discs is that?
One.
Okay, that's what I thought. So I have the 101 Films, which I'm not even sure if they still exist. They were an imprint a while back. I think they were kind of an indie type of thing. And I, like I said, I don't even know if they still exist or how many movies they ever put out. This was their third release, if that tells you anything. Mm-hmm. And it's a two-disc set. And that amuses me no end because it is the exact same film with basically 13 extra seconds, not minutes, seconds of film. Basically just a little more gore in the gory sequences. Probably most famously is that there's more of a lingering shot and a close-up of the dead body at the end of the movie.
Okay.
After it's been hit. And that's really the one that stands out in my mind. The other ones don't really stand out. So, I mean, they obviously don't add much because I've seen this movie so many times, but when I watch the unrated version, you know, the expanded version, none of the other footage stands out. That's the one that stands out. So it really doesn't add much. So it amuses me no end that they bothered to cut a whole nother disc for 13 more seconds.
Yeah, they could have just thrown an outtakes thing on there for 13 seconds. Something. Or just have the unedited version.
Yeah. But apparently they did the edits to keep them from a higher rating, because I think this is a PG, I want to say.
And it wouldn't be PG-13 because that didn't exist back then.
Right. This is either a PG and it kept them from an R, or this is an R and it kept them from an X. I forget, but yeah, PG. I think it's PG and R. Yeah.
Yeah. I can't go for an X.
On the back of the Blu-ray, it actually has the PG rating on it.
Oh, okay. And also mine has a commentary, which, as I said, the commentary, it was not good. And I generally enjoy movie commentaries, but this one was not good. My problem with it is it wasn't informative. It was just two guys just shooting the breeze and tangenting all over the place and not talking a whole lot about the actual film that they were supposed to be commenting on. That was my issue with it. I was hoping it was going to give insights of some sort, like, hey, did you know this about, and it doesn't do any of that. So yeah,
I would taste, just because it came up, I would just note, I've said from the start, I don't do like Patreon or charging people or anything for podcasts. I do this for fun. I put it out there for fun. I'm not looking to make any money. And I don't begrudge others who do it, but I also don't pay for their podcasts. It's just, that's right. You put it out there for free and I'll listen to what's free, but that's it. But I would just, you know, commend Sean, because this is not the first time. A couple of times movies come up and he doesn't hesitate. He did the drop of a hat, a movie he never heard of before. And before we're done texting back and forth, he said, oh yeah, I just ordered it from Amazon. Sean doesn't hesitate to reach into his pocket and buy movies, you know, just on spec that, you know, maybe he's going to like it. So, you know, I, on the other hand, take the cheap method. And when you tell me there's a movie that you want to do, first thing I do is look to see the streaming services I have. And if it's not on one of them, the next thing I do is see if my library has it so that I can just request it.
See, now I feel guilty because I've been doing it as a Jaws Patreon before I was a co-host. So it's that's how I pay for the movies.
You can do whatever Patreon you choose, but, you know, it's just my thing. I just don't do it. But, you know, hey. Like I said, I don't begrudge anyone else anyway. So
this is what I'm glad I purchased.
There are expenses to putting the show on, and I'm not looking for a pat on the back or anything that we do that. But you know, it just, it is what it is. And but I do this, and I consider whatever expenses we have to pay out as the cost of it, of having this as a hobby. And that's all to it. So by way of rating, like I said, I thought I had seen this. I could have sworn I saw this before, but watching it, I have no memory of it. So I felt like I watched it cleanly. I enjoyed watching it. I thought the elements that we've talked about here today, some of the performances, some of the suspense in the story, were all worthwhile. I really enjoyed that I had them. I did think that I did have some issues with the pacing where I felt it got a little slow at points. I thought the directing could have been just a little bit better. I don't think it was bad directing, but I think it could have, I think excellent directing would have brought up a notch. Overall, I enjoyed watching it, but I don't see myself seeking it out over and over again. So I think for me, this is a Jaws 3. I'm afraid that somehow Jaws 3 makes it sound like, oh, you don't like it, it's bad. Jaws 3 is worthwhile. I enjoyed watching it. It's just not, to me, like on the, it's not evergreen, and it's not something that I'm going to seek out all the time. It was a good watch.
I love thrillers, and this scratches that itch for me. It's something that I really enjoyed about this film. It's funny, I had to think about myself on this one and the comfort food aspect of this, because I liked hanging out in this world. I mentioned on the show multiple times world building, and that's something I really enjoy in a film. And I think they crafted this world really well, including the villain in it. I know in my heart I'm giving extra credit because it scratches so many itches for me. I'm definitely going to give this one a high Jaws 2 for me. I wanted to give it a Jaws, and I know I'm giving it a Jaws the same way Paul mentioned Jaws 3 for himself. There are Jaws 3 movies that are comfort food movies for me where I like hanging out in the world, and I will rewatch that film over and over again, even though it's a Jaws 3. This is one I'm definitely going to rewatch again because I really, really had fun with the world. If I were to look at the film in general, I would say, I'm struggling giving it a high Jaws 2 because I want to give it a Jaws, but I know I'm doing it because of my love for the world and the world building versus evaluating it as a movie. But soundtrack, hanging out in the world, everything, this is really, really good. I would actually say if I saw it in 77, it might be a Jaws for me because it's in that place for me. This, I'm so glad you suggested this.
Oh, well, thank you.
Because I had never seen this before. And like I said, I'm really glad I purchased it because this will be a rewatch.
For me, I mean, my knee jerk reaction is, oh, it's Jaws, but it's probably Jaws for me personally, just because it is honestly one of my favorite movies. You know, I've loved it since I was a kid. Trying to be objective and take everything, you know, criticisms and everything else into consideration, pacing of the film. I'm going to object just slightly to Paul saying it's not cinematic enough, or I'm paraphrasing what you said. I mean, I get it. It is very TV movie in a lot of the direction and everything, but I mean, that's the director's background. But I think there were some attempts, maybe not enough or maybe not big enough, some attempts to give it a more cinematic scale, because watching it now, you know, on the big screen in the letterbox format and all that, I can see there are some shots that are quite impressive. You know, some of the city panning shots and some of the camera work they did. So I think there was at least an attempt to try to make it a little more cinematic and not so... I think part of the thing that makes it feel TV movie-ish is a lot of the movie is shot in close-up. So it has more of a TV feel in that aspect. But I think there was at least some thoughts in somebody's brain at some point during the making of it of, hey, we need these big shots. We need more of, you know, a spectacle type of thing to make it feel more, you know, cinematic, more big screen. So, you know, taking all that stuff into consideration, I think, you know, being as objective as it's possible for me to be for something that I really, really have a lot of affection for, I'm going to go a solid Jaws 2, because this is one that, you know, I do rewatch time and time again. And, you know, to my mind, that's the definition of Jaws 2, is it's highly rewatchable may not be a classic, may not be perfect, but it's highly rewatchable. And this movie is definitely highly rewatchable. Great score. I think probably the only thing it misses for me, you know, on that Jaws scale is quotability. I can't think of a lot of quotes that I can pull out of this one. This is not a movie I quote a lot, but it's definitely a movie I find myself thinking about a lot. Especially the ending. The endings, this is one of those movies that really, the ending sticks with me. It's haunting. And I like that aspect of it. And that's how I would describe the music for the most part in the movie, is it has a haunting quality. And that's what I like, especially about, again, the carnival music that's used in the score. It just has a haunting quality. And I really, really like that. So, yeah, solid Jaws 2. I highly encourage anybody that's not ever seen it, or you haven't seen it in a long time. Maybe you saw it and you didn't think much of it. Give it a look. I think it's worth your time.
Hey, cool. So that's it for Roller Coaster. I hope you all had a good 4th of July, and I hope any amusement park time you spent was safe. thanks for listening to us, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Anyone touch the tape? Just Quinlan. Our friend would never leave Prince.
Oh, do I have your guarantee of that?
Well, no, but I think it's obvious.
If you don't mind, we'll let our lab make a determination. We'll send that tape in for voice analysis. And if it was delivered to Quinlan, see if he kept the wrapping.
We'll get him.